Welcome back to Silver Screen Social, listeners. I'm your host, Jackson Vickery, and on this episode, I spoke to Emmy Award-winning and Grammy-nominated composer Jeff Russo about his work on the limited series Ripley.
May I ask you to describe Thomas Ripley? What line of work are you in, Tom?
Accounting.
You're a very hard man to find.
He came to Italy, moved into Dickie's house. He just wouldn't go away.
You like art, Tom? You're in the right place.
You like art, Tom? Well, you're in the right place.
Tom is one of those people who takes advantage of people. He's taking advantage of Dickie.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
False IDs, bank letters. What's going on, Tom?
You crazy?
I don't trust him. He's a liar. It's his profession.
The corpse was found on the Via Piantica, struck on the head by some heavy instrument.
My God. This is what I do for a living. You're interfering.
I'd like you to leave.
I bet you would.
Someone is dead in Rome, and Signor Ripley is missing. This is the situation.
I absolutely love this series. I absolutely love what Andrew Scott is being able to showcase. I love the way it looks. I love the way it sounds. It's cinematic, and it's just so luscious to take in.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extraordinary feat of all the senses.
Mm.
You know, the level of detail. I'm you know, and I speak about it, you know, in the third person almost. You know, I even though I was a part of it, it's like I watch it and I'm like, oh my God. Hold on, I don't know why my video was off. You know, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe how fantastic it looks and sounds and all of these things. It's just, it's really incredible. You know, for me, it was 3.5 years. I was working on it for like 3.5 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a long time. I was talking with Steve from the very beginning, you know, from the very beginning of his getting into production. So.
Mm. And what did those conversations look like at the beginning?
Well, we talked about themes and we talked about, you know, what the sound of it would be. And I started writing and, you know, we were very, very clear. He was very clear. You know, he was like, it's not the movie. We're not making the movie. The movie was something else. It wasn't the book. It wasn't the story that I want to tell based on these incredible novels. And, you know, I understood that the movie sort of took a more romantic turn to it. And in our telling of it, it's very much, you know, about a psychopath named Tom Ripley. I mean, he's crazy. He's crazy is not the right word, but he's definitely sociopathic. He's definitely, you know, a psycho. And it really comes across in our telling of it. And the original sort of conversations I was having with him were, you know, how do we tell this story and make it feel like a classic film? You know, like one of the things he said was, if you are at a loss for what to do, think about what Ennio Morricone might do, like in 1963, like, what do you think he would do? And, you know, I took that very much to heart definitely wanted to infuse melody with a sense of unease, and this tension that goes unresolved basically throughout the entire thing until we get to the very end, where there is a resolution. And I won't tell it to you because you haven't seen the last two episodes yet. But if you know the story and read the books, what you already know is that, you know, he wins. He gets away with it. And that's why there's book two and perhaps a season two. I don't know. So it's very interesting to me to have gone through all eight episodes without really there being any resolution. There's no resolve in terms of what I was trying to do. And everything is just a leaving you wondering what is going to happen in the next episode. So,
yeah. And it just, I mean, you're changing different cities, you're changing different set pieces. I mean, it's truly wild just to see the trajectory of his entire just his entire arc, because I mean, even I think in episode six, when he's trying to dispose of the body of Dickie's friend, and he's just going on this like long car ride through Rome and then having to go back and forth, and it was just like you never knew what to expect. And I just thought it was, I love that about it. And I love it
definitely brings up what we talked about as well, which was, here's this small town is not the right word, small time criminal, this petty criminal who we see at the very beginning in episode one. He becomes a much more intricate criminal, right? And he's learning how to do it as we watch. And that was the thing. It's like when he kills Dickie, he'd never killed anybody before that we know of. So by the time he kills Freddy, what you realize is he really doesn't know what he's doing, disposing of a body. Like, this is the second time he's ever done that. Yeah. So he's like, oh shit, I forgot and I gotta go back. And I get, you know what I mean? And you know, just like where he put the boat, he didn't think about who might see the boat.
You know,
somebody might see the boat.
Yeah, I mean, it's in plain sight, like, even though he burned it and it's down in the, I mean, it's really not invisible. I mean, he didn't really do anything that, and I mean, you kind of get a sense that Dickie's body might float back up to the top, because I think one of the episodes ends and he's kind of just
floating there.
Yeah, floating there, but it's so mad. And it's just the suspense is, honestly, it's delicious.
And to me, like, one of the great things about what I got to do was, you know, I really got to treat the music as another character in the show. And with it being black and white and the style of music that I was able to do, it really just puts you right in the place and time, you know, it does.
So how did you get into Ripley's head when creating his themes and throughout the show?
You know, I mean, I read the scripts before they were shot, and you know, Steve is really, really descriptive. So I started really thinking about his anxiety, you know, Ripley's anxiety of will I be caught? Because he doesn't know, you know, he's been, again, he's starting as a small time thief, small time con man. And now he has graduated to big time con man. Now he's killed someone, taken over their identity while having to manage his own real identity for other people. So, you know, it's like this push and pull thing. And I really wanted to push on that. I really wanted to bring that to the surface, this feeling of I'm walking on a tightrope and I could fall. And every time something clicks into place, even when it's just by the skin of his pants, you know, just by the skin of his neck or whatever the saying is. You know, I wanted the audience to really feel like it could all fall apart at any moment. The whole thing could fall apart at any moment. And that was, you know, that was sort of difficult to do. But that is what I wanted to infuse into the score.
Mm. And how do you balance that unease, that uncertainty through the composition?
Well, you know, a lot of it can be with off-time percussion. I tend to use this one sort of clock ticking sound that I created with a violin or a group of violins all hitting their instrument. And if I take that and put that slightly out of time with the rest of the music, which I've done, and also, you know, having a violin line play one note that's out of tune, to make it feel like, oh, wait, something was just wrong there. And it goes by very fast, but you don't quite know what it is. But it creates a feeling of tension, feeling of unease and, you know, disconnection.
Mm. And it's interesting because, I mean, it's showcased actual clocks. I mean, the importance of Ripley's watch, or well, not Ripley's watch. Well,
Dickie's watch.
Ripley's watch, yes. Dickie's watch that becomes Ripley's watch. And I'm just curious, outside of time, what other elements were you sort of peeling back from the layers of what is the underlying anxiety of?
Well, you know, a lot of times I sort of try to create this undercurrent of strings that play in tremolo that will really sort of give the underpinnings of any score on top that feeling of dread. You know, and a lot of that is infused into the score and into the way it was shot. There's this feeling of dread. And it's not Tom's dread. It's just sort of his world's dread. Like, as he's sort of walking and living through this, he keeps sort of coming out the other side, sort of squeaky clean. Some people in the show, in the story, in his story, don't know what it is they think is wrong with Tom, but they know something is wrong with Tom. And I was able to sort of, you know, reference that with this underlying low pitched tonality that I think contributes to that feeling of unease.
Mm. And what's interesting too, to me, is the not lack of dialogue. There's obviously a lot of dialogue, but in certain instances you're going through, I mean, 10, 15, 20 minutes of nothing. And yep. I'm curious how you as a composer, I mean, is thinking through, I mean, you have this chunk of time that you're having to keep an audience completely engaged. I mean, obviously there's editing, there's cinematography, there's so many different aspects, but as a composer, I'm curious, you're going on a stretch of just like, I mean, that's a lot of time to audience to be completely engaged in every little thing that's happening. I'm curious how you approach that.
For me, first, you have to see the moments in a different way. You have to look at it in a different way. Like, one of the most important things to me as someone who writes score is figuring out not just where music is going, but more importantly, where will music not be? And how does that inform where the music is going? Because the music is only as impactful and important as the silence that precedes it, and also the silence that's after it. Like, you know, you can pull music out and it can be very effective, or you can have a long stretch of silence and then bring music in to either relieve the tension of the silence or to increase the tension of the silence. And, you know, one of the things that keeps, I think, people really, really, really invested is how intricate the entire picture looks. So as it's quiet, like on the boat, for instance, there's no score on the boat, right? Mm. Like they're on the boat, no score. And we were deliberate. Steve was like, there's not going to be any score on the boat, on the boat. And I was like, I had seen the scene and I was like, we can't have any music on the boat. If we have music on the boat, then we're something else. We're not what we're doing. And he agreed. But when we do finally hear music, it sort of makes the entire thing worth it. Right. And we do that a lot. You know, there are moments where there's a long stretch of music, like when he goes, oh, you haven't, I was going to mention something in Seven that you haven't seen yet, but there's a whole scene where it's, you know, him going somewhere and it's, there's no dialogue between anybody. And it's like 11 minutes of no dialogue. And again, that happened in episode, which one, when he goes to, maybe it's episode 5, might be episode 5, when he goes to Palermo, is that 5 or 4? It's 4. Episode 4, end of episode 4, he goes to Palermo, right? I think so. In any case, there's a number, and even when he goes in 6, when he goes back and forth to clean up the Freddy mess, you know, there's a long piece of music that does play there. But it's very interesting, like how we end up using music in places, and then, you know, just after that having another long stretch without any music. And, you know, that's a testament to Steve's confidence as a filmmaker. You know, filmmakers tend to use music as a crutch, and I mean, obviously I'm there if they need it and they want it, but when there's a filmmaker that is really, really self-confident, there's no need. Music is meant to help, guide, and support, not to lead, right? And in this particular film, and I look at it as one long film because that's how we treated it. That was part of the thing, you know, like being very cognizant of where to use music and where we don't need to use music and how the sound will carry and how the visuals will carry. Sound are like, it's, you know, incredible.
Yeah. No, I mean, circling back to the boat scene, and not to use the circling as a meta, but I found it so interesting. Like that, it's in and of itself, just the sound of the boat going around and around, and then the impending, is he going to get hit by it? Is he going to get hit by the weight? And then sort of having that release at the end that he's done the deed and now he's gone.
Right.
Back to shore. It's brilliant. And sort of my final question for you, how does this project differ to, I mean, the other epics that you have worked on in film and television?
I mean, everything is different. The storytelling devices are different. Filmmakers have different vibes. You know, I would say that my approach to telling stories, narrative stories, is the same in all cases, which is I want to tell the story from the point of view of what are our characters feeling, not what are they doing, right? Like, I never want to play like what you see on screen is what you hear in the score. That is boring to me. And you see that sometimes and it's like, it doesn't really do anything for me. I want to know what's happening underneath all of the stuff. So in that way, something like Fargo and something like Ripley are similar in nature to how I like to approach the way I help tell the story. They're very different scores and they're very different narratives. But the idea of how to pull tension into a scene or how to raise the dramatic experience. You know, the thing about Fargo is that Fargo in and of itself is a very dramatic, overly dramatic almost storytelling. So I get to really, you know, play into the drama, which for Ripley is not the case. I was really playing more into the tension and the sort of thrill of it as opposed to the drama of it. You know what I mean? So the, that was the difference in the way I was trying to tell the stories between the two different things. You know, I'm using those two projects because they're the two projects that are closest to one another. I was working on them simultaneously over the last few years. We got finished with Fargo, obviously, you know, at the end of last fall before it came out, and finished with this just in January. But they, because they were sort of being born around the same time, they do share, you know, they do share the same sort of psychic space that I was having to share with both of them. They don't relate to each other musically, but, you know, it's a good way for me to look at it and go, oh, right, I do tend to want to tell stories in the same, with the same ethic, you know, with the same ethos. You know, I don't want to do, I don't want to be on the nose. I don't want to tell the story of what you're seeing on screen. I want to really feel the emotional impact of what the characters are saying and feeling.
Absolutely. And you do it so well. And I mean,
I appreciate that.
Yes. And I mean, Andrew Scott's performance in it is just out of this world and just
spectacular.
Johnny Flynn
and Johnny Flynn as well, like playing, you know, playing Rip or playing Dickie is incredible. Dakota Fanning. I mean, you know, the entire cast is, it's incredible.
And it's just, it for Andrew Scott, it's just such a departure from anything I've ever seen him do. So it's just another thing to add to his tool belt. And I'm along for the ride, and now I'm very curious if there could be, well, I mean, there can be another Ripley, but if there was ever another, I don't know, another iteration of Ripley and what that could be, that intrigues me to a certain degree. So anyway,
we will see.
But Jeff, I want to thank you so much for chatting with me this afternoon.
No problem. Thank you for having me.